Les colloques du Collège de France.
Mauricio, the next speaker is Professor Eric Bree. Who's professor of
USB,
Eric Bree is professor of psychiatry at the Caen University in Normandy in France, and adjunct investigator at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, where he served in different leadership capacities as a medical Harvard Medical School faculty for nearly 10 years. His research focuses specifically on understanding the mechanisms of anxiety and stress-related conditions. So we'll move more to the psychiatric epidemiology part of the day and talk a little bit more about diagnoses.
It's very a pleasure to be here. So I'm going to talk about, so my talk is a little bit more clinical. And I'm going to talk about the impact of trauma and loss and talk about PTSD and prolonged grief disorder. And just to start, I'm going to remind people, so for those of you who have not seen one of these three movies, I'm going to explain what PTSD is. And to understand PTSD, you need to understand what trauma is. And what we define as trauma is a being exposed to an objective event that is either life-threatening or threatening your body. And you could be exposed as a direct victim or as a witness, or whether you learn that someone close to you was exposed to such an event. And of course, when one is exposed to one of these potentially traumatic events, one will develop certain common reactions to trauma, including certain thoughts, including certain emotions, feeling angry, being very alert, having trouble sleeping, etc., etc., etc. But most people are resilient and will recover naturally. However, some people will keep on developing or keep on exhibiting suffering from these symptoms. And per definition, so DSM-5 is our Bible that defines all our disorders. So basically, by definition, it's decided that less than 3 days of post-traumatic reactions would be classified as non-pathological. And then from 3 days to 1 month, it's called acute stress disorder, and 1 month or more, it's what we call PTSD. PTSD is not a psychiatric course here, so just very briefly, PTSD associates over a course of 1 month, 4 types of symptoms. The first type is re-experiencing intrusive symptoms, so you've seen of these movies with nightmares or flashbacks. The second type of symptoms is avoidance, like spending time trying not to think about it, or avoiding places or things that remind you of what happened. And then the fourth type of symptom is change in the way that people think and the way people feel, so feeling either more anxious about the future or having thoughts like the world is a very dangerous place, etc. And then the final type of symptoms is hyperarousal, so having trouble falling asleep, being easy, startled, etc. And so just to clarify how it works, so this figure basically explains it all. You're exposed to a traumatic event. You have an immediate reaction, so fear, helplessness, etc. And over time, usually that reaction will decrease, except that some people, it will not decrease or not fast enough. And after 1 month, we will call that PTSD. So how frequent is this? Well, it depends on where you sit. So in the US, lifetime prevalence is around 8%, the 12-month prevalence around 4%, and it's somewhat lower in Europe. So mostly you basically divide it by two. There's many theories why. So we can talk about it if you want. But what I also wanted to mention is that when you're exposed to trauma, of course, you could develop PTSD, but you could also develop many other conditions. So there's lots of data on that, but just this slide, the old slide with all data showing comorbidities of PTSD. And so as you can see, many people with PTSD will have depression, will have one type of anxiety disorder, and will have substance use or alcohol use problems. So basically, to summarize this, after exposure to trauma, PTSD is only one possible trajectory. And exposure to trauma is actually associated with threefold increased odds in any type of mental condition, mental disorder. So most of you have heard of PTSD before, but anybody has heard of prolonged grief? Prolonged grief disorder? Well, then that's good, you're here. So what is prolonged grief? Well, and you know why you haven't heard of it? You don't know why. It's because of the Vietnam War. You're going to have to follow me here. So historically, trauma and bereavement were studied together, except that in the early 1980s, after the return of veterans from the Vietnam War, there's lots of PTSD, and then there was some recognition of the condition, and that was included into DSM. And then there was a huge burst in all the research on PTSD. And the condition, psychiatric condition related to bereavement, like losing someone close to you, actually didn't get into classification until very recently, 2022, for the DSM-5 text revision. So bereavement, losing a loved one, is a major life stressor as well. That triggers an acute grief reaction with lots of emotions, both positive but also negative, obviously. Some different thoughts, feeling guilty, regret, shame, and certain behaviors, like avoiding certain places as well, but also withdrawal, etc., etc. And all this is conceptualized as a stress response. And the stress response is a response to a certain threat, and the threat is separation. And normally, when you lose someone very close to you, you experience this acute grief reaction, but that grief reaction would change over time. And I usually, without getting into the actual timeline or time frame right now, usually what I tell my patients when I see them to explain, because what I'm explaining here to you is part of therapy we do, we basically tell them, okay, I don't know how long it's going to take, but can you imagine someone who lost someone close to them, like 5, 10, 20 years later? Well, usually if they are doing fine, they will have interest in their ongoing activities and other people. They will have new goals and plans for their life that doesn't account for the disease anymore. They will still feel connected to the disease, but the feelings of yearning, like missing the person, the feelings of loneliness are less intense and less prolonged. And that evolution from acute grief to integrated grief requires several things, including processing the information about the death, that is to say, digesting the reality of the death, and being able to integrate both positive and emotional and negative emotions regarding the loss. Okay, so that's usually what happens normally. But sometimes that process is interrupted, and that's due to complications. People have trouble integrating the reality of the death because they avoid a lot. They avoid thinking about it, obviously. They could avoid or they could have trouble regulating emotions, and they start drinking or taking drugs, or they could actually be thinking about something related to the death, but not to the actual fact that the person is gone. For example, a patient lost her husband on his death bed. The husband said, okay, you know what, honey, I took care of everything money-wise. And then he passed. And then she came home, and actually he hadn't taken care of anything at all. But it's been 10 years, and she's ruminating. Why then did he tell me that? Like, is something wrong? Yeah, what happened, etc. And that actually prevented her from digesting the reality that he's gone, because she spent all her mental time thinking about something else. So when it's stuck like that, we call that prolonged grief. Call that prolonged grief, as I say, in the DSM-5 text revision and also in the ICD-11 since 2018. And we used to call it complicated grief or pathological grief, etc. So per definition, again, not a psychiatric course, but just so that you get a sense of what it is. Per definition is you have lost someone close to you for at least 12 months before. In kids, it's 6 months. And having or experiencing at least one of two main symptoms, that is persistent yearning, longing for the deceased, like missing the deceased, or preoccupation with the deceased. So if it's not missing, it's like thinking about them, like being obsessed by them. And then associated with that, other symptoms, including having trouble believing it, like this feeling of disbelief, but also emotional pain or guilt, feelings of or identity confusion, not knowing who you are anymore, avoiding certain reminders, feeling numb, emotionally numb, feeling lonely, feeling of meaninglessness, and basically having trouble engaging in your life. So you're going to ask me, oh, great. So how often do people get, someone asked me yesterday, how often does that happen? Well, the prevalence is like 1 to 2%. But what is interesting, is I think, is the incidence. So it's basically about 1 in 10 after bereavement will meet criteria for prolonged grief at 1 year post-loss. But of course, this is very influenced by the type of loss. And if you lost someone to a traumatic event, a murder, suicide, etc., then it goes up to 50%, like 1 in 2. And again, I'm not getting into too many other papers here, but after bereavement, prolonged grief is also only one possible trajectory. There's numbers of papers showing that, just one or two here, saying that bereavement is associated with prolonged grief, but also PTSD and also depression. And just a couple of slides to say that, yes, so the condition impacts the person, but it goes way beyond the individual. Just a couple of papers that we did with my colleague Alison Zalta when I was back in Boston on military connected children. So children whose parents were military and deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan, and they came back with PTSD. And what we found is that PTSD was associated, the parental PTSD was associated, or PTSD depression was associated with the kids' difficulty with internalizing, externalizing attention problems. So so you have the impact on the individuals around the individuals through their connections, but also at a broader scope with some data suggesting that the cost to society of PTSD is about almost 20,000 per year per person with PTSD. That includes everything. That's very interesting, because when I say that, I haven't put like slides about how much it costs to treat someone, but actually treating someone is actually very cost efficient, regardless of how much money you put in. All right, so we talk about what PTSD and prolonged grief are. And you're very curious probably to know the treatment approaches. How do you treat that? Or maybe you know, some people are smiling, so maybe they know. No, they're just curious. Well, so obviously people think about medication. Big news or small news, pharmacological intervention. So SSRIs are antidepressants, like Prozac and all its siblings. They kind of work, but it's not very strong. Like we talk about effect sizes, it's actually a very small effect size. So small that in most clinical guidelines, they have trouble putting medication in the hierarchy. So they put different type of psychotherapy as this is the best psychotherapy, blah, blah, blah. And then aside, they put a box stating, and then you have intervention that works, but with the effect that is small, medications. And then they list the medication. So I would like to focus more on psychosocial interventions. And the psychosocial interventions, so these are all the guidelines available in the world. And these interventions that work are called trauma-focused therapies. Basically, it's therapies in which you talk about the trauma. On the right here, you have EMDR. You probably have heard of EMDR. And on the left, you have what we call cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. And it's kind of an umbrella term within cognitive behavioral therapy. You have different types of protocols, including one that is called prolonged exposure and one that is called cognitive processing therapy. I'm going to talk about those two. So more broadly, cognitive behavioral therapies, how do they work? Well, they posit different things. They posit that, as I show you, like this kind of wave, that PTSD is a failure to recover from trauma. And that's due to two things, rather than other. avoidance behavior. So if, for example, I go out there and I have a car accident, I'd be very afraid. I will have trouble sleeping tonight. And if I keep coming here and see the place here and be very anxious each time we talk about Collège de France, and I just close the computer or something like that, well, then I will keep maintaining my fear, right? Because each time I close it, in the short term, I feel better, but then I haven't learned that Collège de France is not dangerous. It was just dangerous. It's not, is it? No. Yeah. Are we recorded? anyway, so what I need to be able to recover from trauma is to have new experiences of the place or of the cues that are not dangerous, and just to integrate the reality that it was dangerous one day, the May 29th, 2026, but not the other days and not the other situations. The second thing is that prevents people from recovering from trauma is thoughts that are biased around the traumatic event or about why it happened. So for example, they would think that they could think that Collège de France is very dangerous, or Paris is very dangerous, or that because you walk and do, like, everything is dangerous, and that kind of perpetuates the fear and perpetuates the symptoms. And so two people, at least, but more, two people with their teams created interventions to specifically target either avoidance or biased thoughts. First one is prolonged exposure, created by Edna Foa, who unfortunately passed away a couple of one month ago, I think. And she had this theory that it's avoidance that perpetuates PTSD. And so she created that intervention based on confronting the patient to memories and situations regarding the trauma. So how do you do that? Well, you actually tell the patient, hey, go back in front of Collège de France and sit there until you no longer feel afraid, and then you can leave. And do that every day for the next 10 days, for example. Or they could, and so that's one way, and the other way would be, tell me what happened, like in all details, and when you're done, tell it again, and cycle through it until your fear comes down, okay? And it's what we call a manualized treatment. And you all know what a manualized treatment is, don't you? No, it's a manual. Manualized treatment is a manual. It's a treatment that follows a manual. All right. But there was the funny thing is, like, if you open the manual at the first page of the first chapter, first line, it reads, "Greet your patient with a smile if you can." So everything is really well. It's a manual. Just read it. Okay. Read it to the patient. It's about 10 to 12 sessions. The other therapy is cognitive processing therapy. Patty Resick, who created it with her colleagues, and it's based on the fact that, the social cognitive theory of PTSD is basically saying that we all live in fairy tales. Don't we live in fairy tales? No, but the idea is that we all grew up we were all raised by our parents, hopefully, to kind of learn that if you do something good, you are rewarded, and if you do something bad, you are punished. And if something horrible happened to you, it's a punishment, right? So if you've been assaulted, if you've been raped, you basically could assimilate with the belief, with the prior belief, and say, wait, if I've been raped, it's because I smiled to the guy, or I shouldn't have smiled to him, or I shouldn't have worn this dress, etc., etc. It's my fault, etc., etc. That's a biased thought, see? Or you could over-adapt. You could say, oh, wait, actually, everything that my mom told me, my parents told me, is wrong. Like, all men are dangerous. The world is actually dangerous, although in 2026, the world might be dangerous. I don't know. But anyway, so that's kind of what we call over-adaptation. And the objective of therapy is to bring the patient to kind of make peace with that. Okay, and so at the end of the therapy, you have a patient who'll say or think things like, okay, in general, if you do good things, you're rewarded. If you do bad things, you're punished. But sometimes, very rarely it does happen that even if you do everything perfectly good or in a good way, something bad may happen. But that's very rare. See? Okay. And it's also a manualized treatment. It's also 12, like this one is 12, the other one is 10 sessions. For the treatment for prone grief, again, medications, they don't work. So that's my former resident, who's now assistant so a professor at the United, well, they, somewhere near Maryland. Can't pronounce it. So we did a couple of papers on medication. The medications don't really work for our prone grief. That's all you need to know. So psychotherapy. And I'd like to introduce you to Kathy Scheer. So she's my mentor's mentor. So I usually call her my grand mentor, because that's probably what how we call your mentor's mentor. And she designed an intervention called initially complicated grief treatment. And because of the new name, et cetera, it's now called prolonged grief therapy. It's 16 sessions. It's individual and it therapy, and it's also manualized. And basically, it's really based on the model I showed you that mourning or grieving is a natural process, and people get stuck because of circumstances. It's not a disease, and so the treatment is to remove all the derailing circumstances, lack of social support, rumination, etc., etc. And she tested, so now there's three very large clinical trials over 1,000 patients total. But this is her first trial and was published over 20 years ago. And she compared her therapy among grievers with prolonged grief disorder to IPT, which is interpersonal therapy, which is a gold standard for depression. And she found that her therapy, what she designed, was twice as effective. It's all significant. All right, so I'd like to spend the last 10 minutes of my talk so we have treatments. How can we bring them to all, right? It's an important question. First, I'd like to orient you to the Centre Régional Psychotraumatisme. Centre Régional Psychotraumatisme were funded in 2018 and 2021. And there's 17 across France, and I'm in charge of the one in Normandy up there. And so the mission is are to treat patients with trauma-related conditions, to train professionals for the region. For the region actually has a, just keep that in mind. And so we got the funding as I moved back to France with a soft start in June 2021. We're located here. You probably are going to wonder why I put this guy up here. So who is this guy? No? So it's William the Conqueror. You know, but he conquered England, not the other way around, just as a reminder, because sometimes people get confused. So I put his face here because he inspired me a lot. Not that I want to conquer England, but what he did is he moved his capital city from Rouen to Caen, and so that he could rule over the entire region, because Caen is very central. And so that's exactly what I wanted to do. So I'm going to start a center right in the middle of Normandy and try to spread everything around, like Guillaume. Fast forward 3 years. We're now 19 staff members, and we do all this standardized treatment. But to bring first-line evidence-based therapies to France, oh, I forgot to mention that besides EMDR, none of the other therapies were available in France in 2021. So we had to, I don't have slides for that. So basically I had to find people who could speak English, hire them, get the manuals, train them, send them to get trained, then have them create intervention and blah, blah, blah. But fast forward a few years, we have the interventions that exist in Normandy. So just a few slides to see what it looks like. And these numbers are exactly the numbers you have in the literature. So for prolonged exposure, for PTSD, the one where you ask people to go back in front of Collège de France, we have a remission in almost 75% of patients and almost 80% of response, which is exactly in line with what you find in the literature. For cognitive processing therapy, it's slightly less, but still it's 80% of response and 70% of remission. For prolonged grief therapy, the one for grief, it took us a little bit longer because there was difficulties in adapting it to like to French. But so we had all my team do that, but we ended up being able to do it. And these are the data, and it looks pretty consistent with the literature. And so you're going to say, okay, so this guy is telling us that there was a problem, now there's treatment, now there's no problem, so why is he up here? And you're right, why am I up here? Well, I'm up here because it's like just it's a flashback of, I don't know, 2016 or something like that. So with my friend Lise Gutter, we conducted a systematic review and meta-analysis of dropout among veterans who received psychotherapy for PTSD, and we found 36% of them. So actually, if people complete the treatment, 8 out of 10 will get better, but they don't complete the treatment. They don't complete the treatment because probably what we found is that probably if you screen them out and they don't have comorbidities, they can respond well, and they don't have issues with their ongoing crisis in life, etc. Yeah, they can complete the treatment. But if they're like random people with their random life, usually there's too many things going on for them to actually complete the treatment. And so we spend quite some time working or trying to overcome barriers to treatment, including individual barriers, like the PTSD symptoms themselves, people avoid. So when you give them a appointment, they usually, maybe 1 out of 3 times they will not show up. They have comorbidities, and they have trouble regulating emotions. And so one of the things we try to do, hey, do you know why we have so all the psychotherapies I mentioned, it's one time a week. Do you know why we do one time a week psychotherapies? Anybody knows? Well, because they were invented in the US where reimbursement is one time a week. So, well, I forgot the slides about the Beach Boys, but basically it's the Beach Boys, the solution. The Beach Boys, so while I was back in the US, I also work in a center for PTSD, it's called Homebase, we were funded by private donors, and because we were funded by private donors, we could create things that were independent from reimbursement policies. And so we thought, hey, why don't we give them the treatment, therapy, but every day? Because if you need 10 sessions once a day instead of once every week, then in 2 weeks you're done, right? And they might not drop out of it. And we're going to put all these veterans together, etc. Fast forward, we did that with Naomi Simon. So on the right, that's my real mentor. And on the left up there, it's Peg Harvey, who worked with us. And basically, we did our first program. It's called an intensive program, where we gave all the treatments every day. And down there is Luisa Silvia, because the veterans came on a Monday. They received treatment every day. On the weekend, they went to the ranch, and then they came back. And then did 4, 5 more days. They received some kind of degree or diploma, and then they left. And they went to the ranch to do horse riding during the weekend. And so that's this paper, because guess what veterans do in downtown Boston during the weekend if they're not at the ranch? Yeah, you guessed or no? Yeah, they're very thirsty people. Yeah, so that's why we had to send them to the ranch. Anyway, so these are the paper. It's really the first paper that was published on one of the first papers that was published on an intensive program. So we had huge effects, decrease in symptoms, big effect size over two weeks. And we say, wow, so they're cured or what? Yes, they're kind of cured or what? With less than 5% of people dropping out. And someone probably has a question now for me. Come on, you have people who got extremely better in 2 weeks. Isn't that miraculous? And no one has a question for me. Really? No one is wondering what happens? Yeah?
It makes sense because it's intensive and people are in, I don't know, it's like individual therapy or group therapy.
So this is a mix of both. The trauma focus is individual, but all the rest was group. So nobody is wondering what happens next? Like, yeah, all right. So I left Boston, so I don't have access to the data, but my friend Alison Zalta, her again, and Philip Held, they had the same data set, well, their data set, but same system of the, in Chicago at Rush Medical University, something like that. They looked at, they modeled the data over 1 year, and actually people kept their gain in symptoms over a year. And so we brought back the idea to France because we have veterans, but we also have adolescents with difficulty regulating emotions, and also adolescents who love drinking, very thirsty kids. And so I just got the funding to do a multi-site mobile intensive outpatient program like this for adolescents. So yeah, but if I come back in some years, I'll be able to tell you what happens to that. But the other question I had is, where are the patients? And where the patients are, as I said, they have all comorbidities, and they're usually in the hospital. And so I thought, hey, maybe we could just go into inpatient units and deliver the psychotherapy right there. And we could do that with, so I asked ChatGPT. ChatGPT said, hey, just get this for you. Well, I didn't get this, but I was still able to get some. I got the funding to do this. So I got these three guys who are now my mobile trauma-focused intensive psychotherapy team, and they're deployed across different hospitals in Normandy. I see that I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go extremely quickly on the fact that it does work, although the response and remission rates are not as good as in outpatients, but they're very sick patients who usually never receive treatment because they have either addiction or they are suicidal patients, so they never get that. I want to go through, so individual barriers, okay? And the main other barriers are systemic barriers, and specifically the availability of therapists. Because how long would it take me to treat everyone with PTSD in Normandy with my team? Now that I have other team tools, well, someone probably can calculate. No, I'm kidding. But okay, 327 years. Like if I do it full time, we do that. So we really need to build capacity. I'm just going to skip on the fact of the treatment needs and go to what we design in Boston with, again, Naomi Simon, my former boss, and Meredith Strani. When we were at Mass Gen, we designed a prolonged exposure training over 2 days, 2 days training, plus 6 months of clinical consultation, supervision. And so I brought that back to France, and we created it. And fast forward with my head trainer here, we were able to deliver like huge amount of training. So this is like the final data that we got. So basically we train about 200 therapist a year, and we ask them over 3 days, and we ask them to complete a survey at 6 months. So this is what they completed at 6 months. I only had like 52% of response rate, but among those, 80% said that they used the therapy, at least, or they started to use the therapy. So we're pretty happy with that. We have in our lab, if you ever come visit, we have a huge map where we scratch it of where we have implemented the therapy. But it's probably not enough. So we translated the manual into, like the manual I mentioned. So that's why we translated it into French now, and we're doing the other therapies. And you're going to ask me, how many psychologists do I need to train? Aha. So another tricky question. I'm really running out of time. So very quickly, we definitely need more psychologists than in the entire region of Normandy. So inspired by other work that we've been doing with collaborations with others, we thought that we'll do what we call task shifting, trying to give the intervention to people who normally don't do that. Fast forward all this. We are now training psychiatric nurses to do that. We have data, and we have follow-up studies trying to both look at ethical implications of training nurses to do that, try to change policies, and also like just to confirm the fidelity, acceptability of doing the therapies by nurses. The future directions are organizing all this into a step care model, using AI to deliver interventions and scalable interventions, but that's the next talk by Professor Sipandi. All right, so that's conclusion. I'm running out of time. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.